abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Friday, January 31st, 2014. Today is your last day to get a free signed copy of my New York Times best-selling book from 2004, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, by joining my LibertyClassroom.com site. Just head on over there, check it out, look around. Check out, at this point, we've got 9 courses. They're all downloadable. You don't have to sit in front of your computer screen to enjoy them. And they're taught by me and by people I trust on subjects like history, economics, and more to correct the stuff that we all got in school. So you'll really enjoy it. Plus, we have Q&A forums. You can get all your questions answered. I mean, this thing is unbelievable, plus a free book. But today's the last day. I don't want to hear tomorrow, Woods, I didn't get to it in time. May I please have my book? I'm just going to pretend you're some raving lunatic and I never had a book giveaway offer. So today's the day. Head on over to LibertyClassroom.com, sign up there, and once you've done that, drop me a note with your mailing address on the contact page, LibertyClassroom.com/contact, and we'll get that book right out to you. Today we are talking to Paul Gottfried, who for many years was professor of humanities at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. He's the author of many books, and I'm just picking out a few at random. The Conservative Movement, After Liberalism, Mass Democracy in the Managerial State, Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt Towards a Secular Theocracy, The Strange Death of Marxism, The European Left in the New Millennium, and most recently, Leo Strauss and the American Conservative Movement. Paul Gottfried, thanks for your time today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Paul, I want to talk to you about your article in the American Conservative magazine, Sleepwalk to Suicide, because, of course, we're in the centenary year of the beginning of World War I, which was a complete disaster. I find that there pretty much is about, there's about a dozen neocons who still defend Wilson's decision to intervene. But other than that, everybody more or less realizes, certainly from the U.S. side, it was a disaster, but even worse from the European point of view. So I want to start off, though, first by having you explain to people who Fritz Fischer was and what the Fischer thesis is and how that relates to World War One.
Well, you know, right now I'm looking at a long German treatise called the Fischer Complex by a man who's almost as old as I am, named Gunther Sprau, and he deals with the rise of Fischer's arguments about why the Germans and I suppose more generally the Central Powers, Germany and Austria, their sole responsibility for the Great War. According to Fischer, the Germans had in fact planned a general war for the purpose of creating a great German empire extending into the heartland of Russia, including the Ukraine, and then chopping off all of eastern France, Belgium, and other areas. And this would sort of bring France and other European powers to their knees. And Germany just needed a war as an excuse for doing this. Now, this argument, I should point out, was very popular for about 6 months in East Germany after the Second World War, but it represented a departure from traditional Marxist-Leninist understandings of the war, which was seen as a struggle among capitalist powers for markets, seen as the last stage of capitalism, which culminated in this international strife, and this would be the beginning of a workers' revolution. So that Fischer's thesis seemed to be focused entirely on German guilt and German blame, and it also tries to establish a continuity between World War I and World War II, arguing that most of the the racialist thinking, the search for Lebensraum that you see in Hitler was already present in the Kaiser's government. Okay, and I would argue that the Fisher thesis rests upon very, very tenuous evidence. One of their major sources to confirm their argument is the a September 1914 a memorandum sent by Theobald von Bethmann Hollweg, the German chancellor, arguing for or presenting the possibility of German expansion into certain regions. The problem, of course, is that there's nothing to suggest Bethmann Hollweg was an imperialist. For several years after he came into office, before the First World War, he tried strenuously to appease England. He stopped the naval program, promised England part of the Berlin to Baghdad railroad line. He did everything he could to bring the English into the German camp, or at least appease England's anger at Germany as a kind of upstart competitor. So there's no reason to assume that Bethmann Hollweg was a man motivated by a desire to start a war. He leaves 1916 because he's opposed to any peace but a peace which will return to a kind of status quo ante bellum. There are also other arguments that Fisher makes, generally by misquoting people. He misquotes von Moltke, the German commander. He grossly misquotes. He misquotes the Kaiser. The arguments presented by somebody like Christopher Walker in his book, The Sleepwalker, that the Germans, for the most part, sort of blunder their way into the war. They have no desire to get into any war, and they feel they have to back up Austria in 1914, because the Serbs really were trying to destroy the Austrian Empire. It was a perfectly obvious threat by then. They had their hand in the assassination of the Archduke and his wife. The operation of the Black Hand in Bosnia was carried out with the support of the Serbian general staff. All of this Christopher Walker shows. It's been known for years. And the Fisher thesis survives largely in Germany because the German government and many of the German academics are intent on showing exclusive German guilt for World War I as a way of keeping the Germans anti-fascist, penitent about their past, their entire past. So they push guilt for World War I as well as guilt for Hitler. However, I think by now you're quite right. Except for neoconservatives, some Teutonophobic German, rather English Tories, to whom someone like Paul Johnson or Margaret Thatcher spoke, there are very few who will defend the Fisher thesis. I even saw it being attacked in the New York Review of Books, so you know that it's all over. You know, if left liberals in the New York Review of Books think it's ridiculous.
So in other words, the Fisher thesis then is situating Hitlerism within an alleged broader tradition of German
right.
imperialism.
Right,
so he's
exactly.
got this sort of, we might say, presentist agenda there. Mm-hmm. But then also, of course, immediately after World War I, there was development of revisionist history in the U.S. of the war, where you had Harry Elmer Barnes, you had Sidney Fay,
right.
and they were claiming that the German war guilt was a lot of hooey, that if
yes.
anything, I mean, Barnes said, if anything, the Germans were the least responsible for the outbreak of the war. So he went completely the other direction.
Right.
But
right.
was the sort of revisionist view that Versailles had drastically overstated German war guilt, was that still the conventional wisdom on the eve of the release of the Fisher book in the early 60s?
Absolutely. I wrote another article on this, believe it or not, for the American Spectator, before it became totally neoconservative, making that argument that into the 1950s, you get people like Raymond Aron and others taking exactly this view. I mean, they were disputing the Fisher thesis. Even the French patriots said, well, you know, the Germans may have been more guilty for the war, but they weren't entirely. Part of the responsibility was ours. We all blundered into it. What the Fisher thesis does is simply change the terms of the debate, trying to use a kind of moral blackmail to do this. you know, if you don't accept this, you don't accept that Auschwitz really happened. By the way, I heard this argument as a graduate student at Yale because my professor, Heil Holborn, together with his disciple, Fritz Stern, were the strongest advocates of the Fisher thesis probably in the world. I mean, even more than Fisher and Immanuel Geis in Germany. They were absolutely passionate about this, and also to show that German history throughout the, well, from Bismarck's time on, they didn't like Bismarck either, you know, was heading in the wrong direction, and that Nazism was, you know, a probable outcome of the peculiar path, the Sonderweg, pursued by the Germans since the period of unification.
Now, today, of course, once we get to late summer, I'm going to start talking on this program much more about World War One, and we'll look at the outbreak. I'm going to have Hunt Tooley on. It'll be great. But right now, as we look at it broadly 100 years on, I'm sure there are people who would look at it and say, this was a period in which you had several openly imperial powers who were rivals of one another, and you had one power trying to encircle another with hostile alliances, et cetera, et cetera. You know, whereas today, and some of them had been involved in struggling over colonies. But today, okay, we have the U.S. as a major imperial power, but not in the same way that those powers were. The likelihood of a full-blown world war between the major countries, excepting the Middle East, seems very unlikely. So are there really any lessons to be learned that would be applicable in 2014 from the blunders that were made in 1914?
Well, the I think you're quite right, actually alluding to something that comes up in my article, The American Conservative, namely that I'm not sure there are too many lessons that would be applicable. And if you notice that while I deplore neoconservative imperialism and global democratic hooey, at the same time I said the United States can get away with things that Germany and France and Russia could not get away with in 1914 because they were essentially in a kind of fishbowl. And because of our power, our military economic primacy, we do get away with pushing around other countries in a way that would have been much harder back then. I do think it is important simply to clear the air to accept the proposition that both sides caused the war. It is not that one is more to blame than the other. Both sides are equally responsible. And I think the Germans have to get this monkey off their back. 10 years ago, Merkel went to France. I think it was 10 years ago, maybe more recently than that. And she apologized to the French head of state that Germany by itself started the First World War. She's the supposedly a conservative Christian Democrat. She apologized. The Frenchman looked at her. She was crazy. You know, I couldn't even remember which war she was talking about. So, I mean, I think the Germans, for their own mental sanity, have to get rid of the Fisher thesis and recognize that while they have some responsibility for the war, it is no greater than the responsibility borne by the other side.
You know, I just had Walter Williams on the program last week, and I love his proclamation of amnesty and forgiveness, you know, where he basically tells white audiences, look, quit making fools of yourselves. I forgive you already. You know,
yeah,
let's
I know,
just
I
go
know.
On. All right, but I suppose one thing, though, that Americans can take away from this, okay, we don't have the same English versus German naval rivalry that existed 100 years ago, but Americans can certainly learn something in terms of how foreign policy is made. And it seems like today, is it fair to say that the range of allowable opinion, now Ron Paul has changed this a bit, but for the most part, the range of allowable opinion in the U.S. is really a choice between Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, right?
I didn't think of that. You're absolutely right. I think this sort of gets back to the question of what relevance does this have for what's for the United States now. And I think in many ways, World War One, much more than even the Civil War, is the beginning, and one might say almost the primal justification for liberal internationalism. That, you know, if Wilson was right, then everything which comes after is right. He tried to make the world safe for democracy. He was justified in intervening when he did. I mean, it's sort of hard to defend his domestic policies. I mean, he was a eugenicist, held strong racial views, whatever. But you can defend his foreign policy because he spoke about, you know, a war to end wars, a crusade for democracy. And these slogans and ideas are very much tied up with American intervention in World War One. So this becomes, you know, this becomes the justification. The Civil War is an internal affair. This is an occasion for the United States to implement its ideas about democracy throughout the world through becoming militarily involved in a European conflict.
Well, how would you describe, if you had to explain the range of debate between Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, how were they different?
Well, okay, I think what you find in Teddy Roosevelt is a more openly imperialistic, naturalistic understanding of international relations. He's very much a child of his times, really of the 19th century. And there were people in Germany, France, England, you know, talking about war as a manly experience. You know, it teaches us virility. Nations prove themselves in military combat. I think with Wilson, however, what you get is a characteristically left-wing form of militarism. That, you know, we're to fight wars. We're to fight wars to end wars. We're to fight wars to bring democracy to the world. You don't get these ideas in Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt, I think, is in many ways a man of the 19th century. Woodrow Wilson sort of creates his own century, which is the century of Bill Kristol, you know, the century of other global interventionists, an American mission to bring democracy. You also get this in Ronald Reagan, even in Barry Goldwater, you get Wilsonian tropes. So I think Wilson is somebody who's sort of looking ahead. I think this is an argument that is also made by John Lukacs somewhere, you know, that that Wilson was the true revolutionary. He was much more so than Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, you know, one of the points you raise in the article is that it was pretty clear, based for one thing, just on the makeup of Wilson's cabinet and the people who were advising him, with the exception of William Jennings Bryan, who wound up resigning anyway. It's pretty clear they had made up their minds already which side they were basically on and which side they would inevitably enter on. And that just rings so familiar because it seems that today, whatever the conflict is, we know the U.S. government has made up its mind. They don't care what the evidence is. When the evidence comes in to show that the bad guy wasn't so bad, it doesn't matter because the sorties are already flying. And like the Serbs were going to be bombed over Kosovo no matter how few Albanian Muslims turned out to have been murdered. You know, it didn't matter. They were going to be bombed anyway. They'd made up their mind anyway. And so that brings to mind the whole issue of William Jennings Bryan because, you know, Robert Gates just came out with this memoir in which he said, I knew that a lot of the foreign policy was totally ridiculous and it was pointless and it was stupid and a waste of money, but I didn't resign because I had to stay there and be the adult in the room. Who do you think was right, Bryan in resigning or Gates in staying on?
I think William Jennings Bryan was a man of conscience. I think he did exactly what he had to. He was right about the Lusitania. History vindicated his position, you know, that in fact it was carrying contrabands. The British were sort of using it to push the United States into war. He read that right. And then with the succession of Robert Lansing, you had a Secretary of State who was somebody who was totally committed to getting us into war. I think Bryan was a man of principle and a man of intelligence.
So how do I take your view of Gates then? was Gates just an opportunist who, sure, he wants the levers of power, and then he gets the best of both worlds because later he can write the hand-wringing memoir?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I don't think he's a man of principle at all. And it's also in the case of Gates, it's curious that, you know, he tells you what a fine fellow Obama is, what a great president, and then of course turns around and sticks a knife in his back to make himself look good. I mean, he really wants to have it both ways. I think he's trying to justify his own presence in the cabinet.
I'm curious to get your views then on somebody like Rand Paul, you know, who obviously is trying to hold up to one degree or another some kind of Taftian approach to foreign policy, and yet at another level, he seems like he's trying to be careful of what he says and measure his words a little bit more, be a little bit more restrained.
Right.
What are your overall impressions of him?
Yeah, I can understand why he is careful in what he says on international relations. He's walking in a minefield. He does not want to get the Wall Street Journal, Charles Krauthammer, the Murdoch media empire beating up on him, because that would be the end of any ambitions he might have to move into the presidency or move up politically. I think his instincts are right. I also find him much more articulate on international relations than his father. My complaint with Ron is that he was generally right in positions he took, but he gave you bad reasons which just snarl. Rand Paul will give you reasons. I mean, he gives you compelling reasons why he takes his position, but I think he is also very careful because he understands that he is associated with the party of war. Republicans more than the Democrats, not only now but throughout history, have been committed to war. As I learned maybe about 2 years ago as an old man, I was deluding myself, but I thought that Robert Taft was the paradigmatic Republican. He's not. You know, it's the Republicans who wanted to push us into World War I, the Republican internationalists. I mean, they really are at the heart of the party. And I think Rand Paul is simply associated with a party that is, you know, is hot to trot whenever, an occasion for war comes along. So I think he's very careful.
Do you think that his presence is symbolic of any kind of permanent shift or movement or at least challenge to the party mainstream on this, or is this just going to wind up as an asterisk or a footnote in history?
It'll be a footnote in history, unfortunately. I don't see how he's going to prevail against the Republican National Committee, against the big donors, against the military industrial complex, if you will. Their defense industries give money to the Republicans. I think in some ways George W. Bush or McCain is much more typical of what we're likely to see as a Republican presidential candidate than Rand Paul.
And so now with Chris Christie, you know, de facto out of the running, I guess we're going to wind up with Jeb Bush?
Why de facto out of the running? I think he can easily get back into it.
You think so, even with everything that's been going on?
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I took this to me, the fact that they launched that federal investigation, I took that to mean there's some reason they really don't like him. Because I bet you that kind of thing goes on with every governor in the union, right?
I mean,
to single him out meant that they're going to be throwing some serious ammunition at him. And so I don't think he's charismatic enough to survive it, but maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think they're going after him because the Obama administration is trying to destroy any Republican challenge to Democratic rule. That's why they use the IRS. That's why they're going after Christie. I don't like Christie, by the way. I mean, I wouldn't vote for him or for Hillary if given the choice. But I think the Democrats recognize that he's a danger to their party, that, you know, he has a good chance of beating Hillary. That's why they're going after him.
You know, I was going to say Roger Stone just tweeted the other day that he thinks that for health reasons, undisclosed health reasons, Hillary's probably actually not going to run. And he said, you know who is going to run? It's going to be Michelle Obama. Do you think there's any possibility to that? I mean, who cares, right? At some level, right? Who cares?
I feel that way, too. I mean, if I had to choose between the two, I'd leave the choice to my dachshund or something. I couldn't make it.
Horrifying. Yeah, no, well, on that note of dystopia, I think we'll draw to a close. But
okay,
I'm gonna in the show notes make sure and link to your article at the American Conservative. I want people to read that. And we need more commentary on World War I. We need more commentary on Wilsonianism and its legacy. We got all year for this 100th anniversary. In fact, we can keep on doing this because 2017, we got 100 years since the stupid intervention. Well, actually,
right,
you know what?
Right.
Before I let you go, let me ask you this question. There are scholars who say, and they're generally scholars on our side of things, but who say that Wilson's intervention had all these unbelievably negative consequences, that if it hadn't been for Wilson's intervention, well, you probably wouldn't have had the Nazis, you might not have had the communists
right.
come to power. And
that's right.
Do you buy into that?
Yes, I do. No, I let's put it this way. If Wilson had sincerely tried to make peace, and the Germans and Austrians were more than willing to make peace, the Allies were not. But if he had sort of pushed his own side toward the peace table, and if some kind of negotiated peace could have been made, the 20th century would have been saved from all these totalitarian nightmares. And I think the American government had it in its power to broker an honest peace. And the Germans were more than willing. It's a very good book, by the way, a man named Hans Fenske. I won't give you the German title, but it's a German work on the attempts by the German government to have a negotiated peace. Is that the Allies never did this. The Germans and Austrians, particularly the Austrians, as we know, because the last Kaiser, Karl, through the Pope, through his cousin in Italy, Sixtus and others, worked diligently to make peace. And the Americans had the opportunity, and they blew it, because the government was intent on going to war against the Germans.
Now, is the argument primarily that in the absence of the U.S. intervention, you would have had either a stalemate or one or the other side would have barely squeaked out a victory, nothing that would have allowed it to get control of any significant territory in the continent or anything, and that then you wouldn't have had this aggrieved party in Germany that feels like they were stabbed in the back, so to speak. You wouldn't have had this unpopular treaty that a populist group could then ride to political success, campaigning against, etc. I mean, is that the basic argument here against Wilson?
Well, yeah, but it goes beyond that. Wilson was also committed to the destruction of the Habsburg Empire, which was a stabilizing force, was a force for peace in Central Europe. And it was not only the Treaty of Versailles that was unjust. Every other treaty was more unjust, treaty with the defeated side, Trianon against Hungary. Hungary lost two-thirds of its territory. Ethnic Hungarians were put under the rule of other countries. Austrians were put under the rule of Italians in the Tyrol. The treaties were totally unjust. The Turks managed to get out of perhaps the most unjust treaty of all, because they just fought on till they got the Treaty of Lausanne, which gave them an ethnically cohesive state. But the other countries were ruined. You also have large German minorities living under Poles, living under others, who were treated very badly in the interwar period. So what the Treaty of Versailles does, or the treaties that end the war, not only Versailles, but Trianon, Saint-Germain, and the other treaties, is to create a kind of permanent festering sore, you know, in the heart of Europe. It was, I mean, every aspect of the treaty of those treaties was unjust. And I think pointed in the direction of another war.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Paul Gottfried, I really appreciate your time. I hope people check you out at paulgottfried.net. And, of course, your books, which I think I've reviewed three of them over the course of my life, have been fantastic and very important contributions. So thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, check out in the show notes for this episode, or you can Google it, the article that Paul Gottfried wrote for The American Conservative, theamericanconservative.com, called Sleepwalk to Suicide, and check him out online as well at paulgottfried.net. His last name is spelled G-O-T-T-F-R-I-E-D. That's it. Another week of programming is behind us. We are still working on transcribing the programs, editing them, getting them ready for publication in a free ebook of all the great interviews we did on this program in the year 2013. This will be made available to you listeners for free. Stay tuned to the program for details on how to get that book. And remember, you are helping us out at no cost to yourself every time you make an Amazon purchase by first entering Amazon through the Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. We'll see you all next week. Thanks so much for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.